This tweet is from Randall in the OC. He tweets, Hawk and Arnold both finished the race. I've lost a lot of respect for marathons.
Yeah!
Two members of the XR4TI ran and completed the LA Marathon. All right, it was an amazing weekend of college basketball. So that being said, you know I'm going to run down my man. He covers college basketball for CBSSports.com. He is co-host of CBS Sports Eye on College Basketball podcast, and we consider him a very good friend of the program. Matt Norlander is my guest. Matt, good to have you back. How are you?
I'm stunned and I guess relieved that Hawk called me. I picked up the phone. I didn't think it'd be him. Thought it might be another member of the XR4TI. When it was him, I presumed that he actually bailed on the marathon. But Jim, hold on a second. Are you telling me right now that this guy ran a marathon and is back in the studio? What's going on here?
Completed the marathon in the studio, rocking the medal around his neck to prove it. It's a real thing. It happened, Matt. I know. We're all kind of shocked, but he did do it.
You know what,
it.
Though? I'm going to need video evidence to make sure we don't have, was it Rosie Ruiz back in like 81? We need the clones to fact check this whole thing.
No, he did. He did. It took him like 12 hours, but he did do it. All right, so let me ask you this. How many times have you watched the replay of Aubrey Dawkins tip it in at the end of the UCF-Duke game? And, Matt, are you like me in thinking that that shot is going to go down every single time and never does?
Yeah, you know what? You know what came to mind? I've watched it at least 15 times. I still can't believe that Denim Brown shot did not go in 2006 to knock out George Mason in the NCAA tournament in the Elite Eight there, because this is what we see happen so often. And, you know, it's part of the drama, part of the heartbreak. And frankly, I think for casual fans that watch this tournament and root for their brackets to be blown up, part of the frustration is that the higher seed of the blue bloods, the big dogs, they just almost always seem to escape in these kinds of situations. You can't even believe that ball didn't fall in. Not only that, though, if Taco Fall doesn't foul out, and he deserved to foul out, don't get me wrong, but if he doesn't foul out, RJ Barrett's not grabbing that offensive rebound to put it back and put Duke up by one late. So for UCF, you had to have three or four things not go your way for Duke to escape. Of course, Duke is Duke, and things wound up going Duke's way. It moves on. But I will say this. There's been a lot of talk, Jim, about how Zion Williamson has made Duke likable. I have no issue with Duke, but I reject that premise. No, Zion Williamson has made Duke very watchable, more watchable than it's ever been. But I posted on Twitter during this game, I was like, you know what? If Zion Williamson actually has made Duke likable, then if you're watching this game right now and you normally don't like Duke, you're going to be rooting for them to win. And I got, as the kids say, ratioed into the ground. By no means were people rooting for Duke to win that game. But if you're also honest with yourself, having a Duke versus Virginia Tech matchup in the Sweet 16, just a little bit more enticing and appealing than, say, a UCF versus Virginia Tech matchup. So we have that to look forward to in what is a very stout Sweet 16 slate of games.
Matt Norlander joining us. I like it. All right, so if you're Buzz Williams and you're Virginia Tech and you've already beaten Duke once this year, and yes, they did so without Zion, but if you're Buzz, what are you taking away from that game?
Well, I mean, you're taking away, one, that we're going to play this game relatively close to Blacksburg. We get it in D.C., and we know we're going to have a pretty good strong contingent. You're taking away that we didn't have Justin Robinson in that game, and now he's back. We get to be refreshed. We get to, by the way, it will, for Virginia Tech to play much closer second weekend than it did first, I think is no insignificant thing. And then Duke, much has been made about how poor it is from three-point range. It might be becoming a tired talking point. Jerome Bettis is from Detroit, if you have not heard. But guess what? It's relevant. 30.7% from three-point range. Duke will regress to its mean. Virginia Tech, on the other hand, loves to shoot it from deep, does often, makes 40% of its three-point shots. It's top 10 in America from three-point range. Now, we've seen some freaky stuff in the tournament already. You know, take example, we saw Wofford, Kentucky. You have the most prolific three-point shooter in the history of the sport have the worst statistical game from three-point range ever in the tournament. That's Fletcher McGee, 0 of 12. No one had ever shot that many threes in a game, in a tournament game, and not made one. And the guy who's made more than any wound up doing it. So the tournament can be freaky like that. So potentially we get some sort of weird thing where Duke shoots 45% from three versus Virginia Tech. Virginia Tech goes cold, only makes 15% of its threes, and onward will go the Blue Devils. But the statistics don't say that's going to happen. And when you have the confidence that you've already beaten this team, I think it plays into an advantage for Virginia Tech. I think it's going to be really close. It's going to be hard to top what Duke-UCF was in terms of a watch, because that was a tense game the whole time. Aubrey Dawkins played the game of his life. But I do think Virginia Tech has a real chance to knock off Duke. I think that would be not as surprising of an upset as, say, three or four other potential possibilities in the second weekend. Like, Oregon beating Virginia to me would be much more surprising, for as hot as Oregon is, than Virginia Tech over Duke.
Matt Norlander joining us. There is so much to unpack in that. Let me get you to stay on Kentucky for a minute. Again, Wofford gave Kentucky everything they could handle, and they did so, as you point out, with Fletcher McGee going 0-for-12 from deep. Matt, if you're John Calipari, how worried are you about what that means against Houston this week, or are you all about survive and advance without P.J. Washington?
P.J. Washington stuff is huge. Him not being available, first of all, that whole situation was a little bit shifty there because it seemed like Calipari was kind of trying to pose it at the start, like maybe he'll be available, and then the next thing we know, he's in a hard cast. He's got the leg on the little wheelie deal there, and now, I mean, maybe he's going to play, but no P.J. Washington. I mean, he is such an important factor. I mean, he is the team's leader. He is by far the most important player on that roster. Now you play a Houston team that is not built the way that Wofford is. They're very different teams. So maybe you embrace that kind of change of style. This is a team that's more built to play. Like, Kentucky would rather play Houston than Wofford, I think, if you gave them the chance, even though Houston has rated as a better team. Defensively, I think Houston will be good to go. They're guard-oriented, so I think it'll be a pretty fascinating matchup there, like Ashton Hagans on Corey Davis, maybe Galen Robinson. That'll be pretty fun. What Kelvin Sampson's done has been awesome. It's been amazing. They finally get to the Sweet 16. We know last year they got Jordan Poole at the buzzer. They finally break on through. I have Houston going winning this game. I think it'll be close. It'll be low scoring. It'll be a pretty fascinating watch. And that game, in fact, is going to, if you're trying to set up your Thursday and Friday here, that game will be snug up against Duke, Virginia Tech. So the best window of the Sweet 16 will be the late Friday window. Have two screens ready because it's going to be an awesome one. But I do think Houston will move past Kentucky and get to the Elite Eight.
Matt Norlander joining us. Matt, go back to Oregon for a minute. They're the only double-digit seed left, but they were a preseason top 15. They certainly did not look like a 12 yesterday in the way they pulled away from UC Irvine. How different is this Ducks team from the one that lost three straight to Oregon State, USC, and UCLA only a month ago?
Oh, it's noticeably different. And now, it's still, I will say this. Now, they're hot. They haven't lost since February 23rd. By every single measure, Oregon is the worst team left on the field. They are hot. Maybe they're one of the hotter teams. But if you take into account everything they've done this season, I mean, they're 29th in KenPom. The top 14 teams at KenPom are still alive. LSU is 18, and Oregon's all the way back at 29 there. Defensively, they've been great. Kenny Wooten is a clone, pun intended, of Jordan Bell. Like, when we saw what Jordan Bell did 2 years ago getting Oregon to the Final Four, Kenny Wooten's done a lot of that. Lewis King is playing better and better. And for them to have done this, you know, Bol Bol goes down early in the year without an injury. They haven't even had him. They've overcome that in part, not because of a big man, but Peyton Pritchard. Some of the shots he hit against Irvine to knock out the Anteaters were just absurd, like vintage March Madness stuff, just step-back threes, really, really impressive. But that said, it's a defensive-oriented team. I know that game against Virginia is expected to be slow, like really slow, like first to 60 probably wins. But Virginia's got a really good offense. I know we were all kind of gripping a little bit with that Gardner-Webb start, but they rallied to win by 15. And then Oklahoma was just within shouting distance. But I still think Virginia is going to beat Oregon. And it's going to beat them in a way where it's like, you look up and the final scores say like 64-58, but it feels like 66-48 kind of deal. I don't think it's unthinkable that Oregon can win, but I think Virginia won't get too much of a push here against the Ducks.
We're covering as much ground as we can with Matt Norlander. He joins us once again. Hey, Matt, Coby White had 17 points. He had 6 rebounds in North Carolina's bludgeoning of Washington. You did a video piece of him for CBS Sports, and in that piece you pointed out he is the highest scoring freshman in UNC history, breaking MJ's record. When you look at Carolina's incredible history, have they ever had a freshman like him?
They haven't. Thanks for bringing that up, by the way, Jim. I appreciate that. Yeah, do check that out if you could. Coby White's got he's got one heck of a story. I actually think he's now the most, with John Morant out of the tournament, the non-Zion division of the most watchable players, and there's still plenty of fun dudes. But to me, Coby White, he's almost got like a little Russ Smith in him in terms of unpredictability, but fantastic scoring guard. You know, he never thought he would be at North Carolina, but he committed only a few days after getting an official offer. His father was still alive then. His father got diagnosed with cancer, and that disease took him quickly. So his dad never got to see him play in a uniform, and it's kind of been a bittersweet thing for him. But he is a fun guy to watch. I talked with Roy Williams multiple times throughout the season about what it's been like to coach Coby, and there's a lot of talent on this roster. Like, I'm not trying to shortchange Luke May, Cam Johnson, what they've been able to do. Nasir Little is coming on so strong, where if Nasir Little can play like this, then yeah, they can win the national championship. But Coby White can go. I mean, he is the fastest point guard that Roy's ever had, not named Ty Lawson. And the way that he can score, distribute, and yet sometimes, yeah, he can get a little ahead of himself. He's a freshman, but they have never had anyone like him. And he is, it's not just the scoring stuff. He has set marks that have not been done by UNC freshmen before. So he makes, to me, more than anyone, UNC as must watch as it's ever been. And that's still a loaded reason they got there. You've got some big time coaches still around, but I still like North Carolina to come out of the Midwest.
All right. So before you go, you mentioned John Morant. Back on Thursday, you were in Hartford for the John Morant show. What did you make of what you saw?
It was amazing. So just real quick to set the scene. So Vermont took up half the building because they come down from the Green Mountain State down to Hartford, and their team loses a good one to Florida State, but they stick around for the second game in that session. Everyone's on Murray State. Morant's wowing the crowd. It's kind of a smaller building, not an NBA arena, so it made for some cozy confines. It was terrific. Morant had, honestly, considering it was the first triple-double since Draymond in 2012, only the 17th ever, ninth official one, I guess. One of the 20 best games by a player in NCAA tournament history. Like, it's absolutely absurd. And then I had a chance to talk with Ja after they got knocked out. Like, a 28-point loss. Get this, Jim. Like, 28-point loss. You started hot. Florida State just overwhelms them. A lot of guys in that spot, you know, end of your season, almost certainly the end of your college career, if you want to fulfill your media responsibility and kind of make your way on out, like, it's totally understandable. But I posted a video to social media, to Twitter, which since melted my mentions down, but that's a whole other story altogether. But what people don't know is, like, Ja was sitting or standing in the entryway waiting for the media timeout to come, and it was about 4 or 5 minutes. Like, he could have been like, you know what, like, I'm just going to head out. But no, he just waited, had his buddy, had a couple teammates with him, and he didn't know who he was going to give the shoes to. He just happened to walk behind the Purdue bench, and there was a young boy there, gave the shoes. And then Jim, when he was doing this, it was interesting because he's got like a little bit of his eye on to him in this regard. Like, pregame, people want to get the photos of him. They're calling his name. And then all of a sudden, everyone realizes he's walked back into the arena. Because remember, his game's been over for about 45 minutes to an hour at this point. Most people think he's left the arena. So everyone starts, you know, taking photos, screaming for him. As he leaves, after he takes the photo with the kid, a little boy named Nash, the whole section like stands up, gives him a round of applause. He's got people reaching him for high fives. And he kind of just dips back into the tunnel, into the quiet, heads off to the bus with his career over. Tremendous kid. Huge, huge, great character with him. Couldn't have been more impressed with what he did in Murray State and made us believe for a little bit. But just like every other potential Cinderella, unfortunately, it got knocked out well before to the Sweet 16.
Still, a moment like that, Matt, only at the NCAA tournament. And I agree, Ja is just so electric, both on and off the floor. That really was a great moment. And I'm glad you captured that. He covers college basketball for CBSSports.com, co-host of CBS Sports Eye on College Basketball Podcast. Good friend of the program. Matt, we got to do this again before the end of the tournament. Great job.
You got it, Jim. Thank you so much.
Have a great day, Matt. Well done. Matt Norlander. I try to cover as much as I possibly could over the weekend. You can't cover the entire thing, but we got a lot done, right?